You're with All in the Mind on ABC RN. I'm Lynne Malcolm, and I want to take you back to the early 1960s.
Come on, everybody, clap your hands. We're going to do the twist, and it goes like this. Come on, let's twist again, like we did last summer. Yeah, let's twist again, like we did last year.
The swinging 60s. To some, it was an era of irresponsible flamboyance. To others, one of social revolution. And although more than 15 years had passed, the Holocaust was still fresh in people's minds. The 1960s also saw the rise of a popular TV show called Candid Camera, where mystifying or embarrassing situations were set up in the street and passers-by were secretly filmed, making fools of themselves. A kind of social psychology experiment, if you like. It was in this context that the young, ambitious psychologist Stanley Milgram undertook his notorious obedience experiments at Yale University in the US. Unsuspecting participants were asked to inflict electric shocks to people behind a screen when they made mistakes in so-called learning and memory tests. His results caused a worldwide sensation and were said to show that we are all capable of evil acts given particular situations. Questions around the ethics of the study quickly ensued. Yet the Milgram experiments have lived on in people's imaginations for nearly half a century. Books, films and game shows have been based on them. Author Gina Perry, having studied psychology in the mid-1970s, was intrigued by Stanley Milgram and his work and decided to find out more. The result is her recent book, Behind the Shock Machine, The Untold Story of the Notorious Milgram Psychology Experiments. Come now to the recent Clunes Back to Booktown Fair in regional Victoria, where I'm speaking at a public event with author Gina Perry and Associate Professor Justin Oakley, bioethicist and moral philosopher from Monash University. Gina Perry begins by explaining the experimental setup back in the early 1960s.
Milgram advertised in the local newspaper for volunteers for an experiment about memory and learning. When they arrived at the lab, they were met by a man in a lab coat who introduced himself, and he was the experimenter that was running the experiment. And there would always, surprisingly, be someone else who'd also supposedly volunteered for the experiment would be waiting there, having arrived a little bit early. The experimenter told both people who were in the lab that they were running an experiment, a test about the effect of punishment on learning and memory, and that one person would be given the role of teacher and the other would be given the role of learner. So both people drew lots. One person got the role of teacher and the other one got the role of learner. The learner was taken into another room and strapped up to a shock machine. And the person who got the role of teacher was taken into another room and seated in front of a machine with switches that designated the voltage levels and told that each time the learner gave the wrong answer on a memory test, they had to give them an electric shock. And with each wrong answer, they had to increase the voltage. What the person who genuinely volunteered for the experiment didn't realise was that the learner, that is the other volunteer who'd been waiting in the lab when they arrived, was actually an actor, and the experimenter was also an actor. And the experiment wasn't at all about memory and learning, but to test how far people would go in obeying orders from an authority figure.
So what motivated him to conduct these experiments?
Milgram was very much influenced by the very high-profile trial of Adolf Eichmann, who was one of the leading Nazis who'd been captured in 1960 and put on trial. And Eichmann, like many of the leading Nazis, argued that his behaviour during the Holocaust was simply a matter of obeying orders, and that that was basically his alibi. So the televising of that trial had a huge impact in the US at that time. It was the first time that the Holocaust as a term came into popular usage, And people like social psychologists in particular during that period were very interested in what had motivated and sustained the mass extermination of Jews during World War II.
And so the stereotypical story, what does it tell us about human nature? And I'll ask Justin to answer this one as well. So, Gina.
The stereotypical story about what Milgram's experiment tells us about human nature is that inside all of us is a concentration camp guard just waiting to be let out, and that particular situations will bring forth that behaviour in all of us. I know I'm describing it in a way that sounds slightly ridiculous, but that is certainly the way Milgram portrayed his results and how his results have been portrayed ever since.
And Justin?
Really, at least in ethics, there's been this big debate about the influence of character on people doing the right thing or the wrong thing compared to minor situational things like being in a bit of a hurry or being ordered to do something. So I suppose the familiar kind of lesson of the Milgram experiments is really that it doesn't matter so much what sort of character you have, what sort of perhaps virtues that you have, that if you're ordered to do something, if you're ordered to shock another person, then people will do it, really, no matter what sort of character or personality they have.
So, Gina, you decided to sort of look further into this, and you argue that the commonly believed picture of Milgram's story is inaccurate or perhaps falls a little bit short. Just tell us how this official story might deviate from what was otherwise believed.
I think the most striking thing for me is that the traditional story about Milgram's experiment is that the majority of us will go to 450 volts on a electric shock machine to administer punishment to someone we've never met, and at the urgings of someone in a position of power. When I looked at that, I realised, number one, that 65% actually was the first study that Milgram published, and it involved 40 people. So I suddenly thought, wow, we're talking about something that supposedly applies to humankind, and we're talking about a sample of 40 people. But also I found that Milgram conducted the experiment with 24 variations, if you like, sort of mini dramas. And in each little mini drama, the script was slightly different, the characters did different things in order to test different elements of the story. And I found that overall, in over half of the experiments that Milgram conducted, 60% of people disobeyed. So, in fact, the common story that we've come to believe is the reverse of what I found in the archives in terms of Milgram's results.
Author Gina Perry. In the process of writing her book on the Milgram experiments, she tracked down some of the original participants to find out how they were affected nearly 50 years on. She found that people's versions about what happened in the lab were very different from what Milgram had written in his book Obedience to Authority in 1974. The most striking thing she found was that people could recall in vivid detail what happened and how they were affected emotionally. Their views about themselves had been profoundly shaped by their experience. Gina Perry also found that the Milgram experiments had been reenacted in 1973 at La Trobe University in Victoria, more than 10 years after the experiments were done at Yale. Two of the participants at La Trobe were in the audience, and I spoke to them afterwards.
My name's Diane Backwell.
Tell me your memory of your involvement.
Well, I went along. It was a little caravan that the La Trobe psych department had purpose-built, and the girl that had asked me to help her was behind a screen. There was another person there who was the prompter. I would ask a question, and to start with, she got the questions correct and everything was going along fine, and then she got a wrong answer and I gave her the shock. And then she continued to get a number of questions wrong, and the intensity that I was giving her, the shock, increased. And if I would question it, the person beside me, her Pratt partner would tell me that I had to keep going. Then she started to make louder and louder noises and screamed, and I remember saying, this is ridiculous that I can't do this, and the person beside me was saying, you have to keep going, you're committed to do this, you know that she'll fail if you don't do it and she's got to learn it. And then the last one was when she was silent, and I didn't know whether I'd actually killed her, and just remembering the ridiculous thought process that if she's already dead, then another one's not going to hurt. And if she's not, then I've got to keep doing it, because if I don't, it's going to be my fault that she has to leave university.
Mm. And after that, were you consoled in any way?
It was the opposite to consolation at the end of it. She came out from behind the screen, and she and her Pratt partner, it was almost like they thought it was really funny, this joke. It's like, oh, you didn't really shock me. The experiment wasn't on me. The experiment was on you, and you went the whole way. Like, you would have killed me. You were like one of the people that did that to the people in the Holocaust. And then it was just disbelief. And I got back to La Trobe, and my friend Aid was there, and I told him about what I'd just done, and he said, yeah, I know, I was in that as well, but I told them where to go. And I remember feeling just that made it even worse, because it was like it wasn't the experiment itself. We both underwent the same thing. He'd chosen not to do it and I'd chosen to do it. So it was absolutely definitely a statement about who I was.
Mm. And how do you think it's affected you as a person since? It was a long time ago. How has it affected you over all those years?
Well, I haven't actually stopped thinking about them since they happened. Back in 1973, has been just part of who I am ever since that day.
Well, I'm another Diane, and in 1973, I was approached in really the same story in what Diane has said, but I think I read about this in the newspaper. Couldn't believe it. It was on the front page of one of our daily newspapers. I must say it was cathartic, and it was felt quite good that other people had experienced these shocking experiences, to use the pun, as we all have been, I think. But it's always with you. I mean, I have thought that I've risen above it or beyond it in the 39 years, but certainly with it coming out again in recent times, you realise that it is with you. I'm probably now as angry as I was 39 years ago that the powers that be will likely get away with what they did all those years ago.
It's just one thing. Roger was a person who did the experiment back in 1973, and he pulled out. He gave a couple of shocks and then stopped and left. And when he was interviewed for Gina's book, he said, the thing that haunts me about it is, how would I have lived with myself if I'd kept going? I've thought about it many times over the years. It had a profound effect on me. I'd been the sort of kid who went along with others, even if I knew something was wrong. So that sense of relief afterwards, I was just so relieved. And when I read Gina's book, it was like that said everything for me, because for the rest of Roger's life, he had that to hold on to, that he didn't do it, and that was the inner core and essence of him. Whereas for me, I had done it, and the rest of my life I knew that, to use the words of the man in America, that black evil part was my core. So that's the effect that it had on me.
Diane Backbull, and before that, another Diane, both participants in the reenactment of the Milgram experiments at La Trobe University in the early 1970s. And you can hear how deeply some of the participants in the Milgram experiments have been affected. You're with All in the Mind on RN, Radio Australia, and online. I'm Lynne Malcolm. And now back to our session, Behind the Shock Machine, Did Science Go Too Far? It was at the Clunes Back to Booktown Festival in regional Victoria.
author Gina Perry and moral philosopher Justin Oakley are on the panel, and we go on to discuss what impact the Milgram experiments have had on the way we conduct science today.
I mean, it's pretty clear that with the research ethics guidelines that we have today, that the Milgram experiment would not be allowed. And that would be mainly for two reasons. One, because of the kind of deception of the subjects that was involved. And, you know, clearly in a lot of social science experiments, there's a need for some level of deception. But what is required now is that people who are being invited to participate in an experiment have to be told the nature of the study and have to be asked for their informed consent about it. And so that may not always involve telling them all of the details of the study, but they have to understand the purpose of the study, and they also have to be told about the possibility of harm and sort of discomfort to themselves. So, you know, these days, the kinds of research ethics guidelines we have would actually, I guess, if they apply to Milgram, you know, they would require him to seek that kind of consent in advance from the subjects.
So it raises the question about current codes of practice and whether it actually affects science and the progression of science. You know, we're not allowed to do a number of things now.
Well, that's right. I mean, these days, all scientists, whether they are social scientists or perhaps biomedical scientists, they all have to apply to a human research ethics committee based at the institution where they're planning to do the research. And they need to obtain approval on the basis of what the proposal is, the proposed experiment is.
So do you think that there's an element of slowing science down, or are they necessary and should possibly even go further to protect participants in experiments?
Yeah, I think there is an element of slowing science down. And, you know, often scientists will say, will express incredible frustration at having to get ethics approval for a study. But, you know, a lot of people on the ethics committees tend to see their role as an educative one to help the scientists understand the importance of treating their subjects with respect, which means obtaining their informed consent in advance, amongst other things. So I certainly think that there's an element of slowing science down, but that's the price that needs to be paid to do science ethically, I believe.
Justin, one of the reasons that Milgram experiments are seen as immoral is because of the psychological stress that his participants endured, and it's this concept of deception that really is at the heart of the controversy. That's what is considered most devious and wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is, and, you know, the experiments involve deception at a number of levels. You know, first of all, you know, as Gina has explained, it's clear that there were no shocks being delivered to the person in the other room, or the person in some cases sitting right next to them. So there was that deception. There was also deception about the purpose of the experiment. There was deception about the role that was being played there, where you thought you were the teacher and the person whose responses were being studied was the learner, but it's actually you that's being studied and what you were willing to do in response to authority. And also, I think another really important point that was raised at the time, actually, in a study by Diana Baumrind, was about the betrayal of trust of the research subjects or the participants themselves. You know, they trusted the experimenter who was sitting there telling them to go on, you know, please continue, the experiment requires that you continue. And trusting Yale as an institution, you know, an Ivy League university, that they thought wouldn't be getting them to do something unethical. And so I think just the layers of deception with the Milgram experiment are the things that still, from my point of view, are a great concern.
And you've just raised the importance of debriefing afterwards. Ordinarily, scientists are required to debrief their subjects following conclusion of the experiment. And Gina, you write that Milgram intentionally avoided doing this, which further compounded the negative feelings for some of the participants towards the experience.
Yes, I found the most extraordinary thing, I think, for me in doing the research for this book was, as I said earlier, hearing these stories from people that were so at odds with official accounts, and the consistency, I guess, initially when the first person told me that they'd left the lab And this person was Bill Menold, who I interviewed earlier on. He left the lab that night and went straight home to his neighbour, who was an electrician, and went to his neighbour and described the experiment because he was so concerned about what he might have done to the man in the lab. And while he was telling me this, I was completely thrown because I couldn't work out why he would have gone home to talk to an electrician, because Milgram had always argued that his subjects had received careful debriefing before they left the lab. And when I interviewed him, here we are this year, 50 years later, he still describes himself as having a core of evil that he did not know about until he went through that experience and that experiment. And I think for me, that's the second disturbing and upsetting part about the Milgram experiments from my point of view, is that people who took part in it have accepted that explanation of their behaviour. And every time it's discussed publicly in the media, it's reinforcing a view of people. So people like Bill, who I meet and talk to and come to, over a period of 4 years, come to admire and I feel very fondly towards. But the reality for him is that every time the Milgram experiments are invoked, the subjects are described as perpetrators, or the equivalent of perpetrators of the Holocaust. So it reinforces this terrible view, and I find that something I feel really strongly is absolutely and unequivocally wrong. So for me, the ethics of the experiment don't just apply to what happens to people in a lab and what you say to them before they go home. It's how you speak about them forever after, and I think they've been done an enormous disservice.
Well, let's now have a look more closely at how Milgram's work has informed us, or misinformed us, as the case may be, about human nature and society. Every decade or so, you know, a group of individuals behave so despicably that concepts of evil and obedience are socially revisited. Justin, what does Milgram tell us about the real world and how we behave?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a huge debate in ethical theory and in ethics generally over the last 12 years, particularly because of the kind of revival of an approach known as virtue ethics, where you're doing the right thing, or the judgment of your action is right, depends on what character traits you are displaying. There's this been this big critique of that, saying, well, look, it's not so much what character we have. If you look, for example, at whistleblowers, it's not that they are more courageous than the rest of us. It's just that they happen to have a more secure employment relationship. They were senior employees. And for all we know, casuals might be just as courageous if they were put in the same kind of situation. So there's been this big critique of a kind of reliance on character as what will actually predict whether you will do the right thing. But I guess the latest responses to that, which are really interesting to think about in this context of Milgram, is that a lot of the studies are very simplistic and don't take into account the sort of construals, how the subject sees a situation. And this is something Gina brings out well, I think, in your book, is really it's not just as simple as you put a whole range of people into a context and you just vary one thing about the situation. But you need to ask the person themselves, the participant, the subject, what they thought was going on, what they took to be going on. And I think that's really important in the lessons we can learn from the experiments that we're talking about, the Milgram experiments.
Yeah, I totally agree with Justin's point of view on that. And also, I think it's interesting that even though he said that it was the power of the situation, Milgram really did construe his experiment as a moral choice, and he decided and regarded and wrote about his subjects as the people who he felt, the people who went to maximum voltage on the machine, he saw as having failed a moral test. And he was quite judgmental and negative about them as a result, which isn't surprising given that he was also in the same breath drawing the parallel between them and concentration camp guards in World War II. So he was very ambivalent about his own subjects, and even though he said it was the situation, he blamed individuals' character by describing them in such a judgmental way. I think that that's really stood out for me in terms of you know, the way he's talked about his subjects subsequently.
All right, we'll just finish up. Justin, what lessons do you take out of Milgram's experiment in terms of what ought to be and what ought not to be allowed when experimenting on human beings?
Well, I think three key values. First of all, transparency to the people you're experimenting on. And secondly, respect. So showing them the sort of respect that you think perhaps you yourself deserve or should be shown to anyone, so not treating them as objects. But also sensitivity, just to echo the points that Gina has been making about empathy. So I think that Stanley Milgram had a misguided understanding of what scientific objectivity meant. It didn't mean that you had to be, you know, completely cut off emotionally from what your subjects, not just at the time, were experiencing, but obviously as the sort of variations on the experiment went on, it was clear to him just how distressing it was for hundreds of subjects over a long period of time. And so, I think these days, scientists, hopefully a lot of scientists anyway, understand that, you know, taking a scientific attitude, being objective, does not mean entirely, sort of depriving oneself of a capacity for empathising with your subjects and understanding what they're going through as a result of the procedures that you're subjecting them to. So, and I guess from what I've learned, just how kind of self-aggrandising he was as a person to come up with this marvellous discovery that would sort of make his name as a psychologist and, you know, teach us all something. So he just seems to have been a rather misguided person from my point of view.
So, Gina, if you could correct one mistruth or change one public perception about the Milgram experiments, what would that be?
I think that we've all been tricked just the same way that those volunteers were tricked into believing that that experiment was real. I think we've been tricked into believing something about Milgram's experiments that isn't true. But I think the thing I'd most like to change would be that the people who took part in the experiment didn't believe badly of themselves as a result. That would be one thing. I would like people like Bill Menold, the people I've interviewed here in Melbourne who took part at La Trobe, who I know still feel very disturbed and unhappy about their behaviour back then. I wish that they wouldn't accept the label that's been put on them, and I really wish that that was something that we could change.
Mm. Okay, well, thank you all for coming. Enjoy the rest of the festival.
Gina Perry, author of Behind the Shock Machine, The Untold Story of the Notorious Milgram Psychology Experiments. And also on the panel was Associate Professor Justin Oakley, Director of the Centre for Human Bioethics at Monash University. The discussion was recorded at the Clunes Back to Booktown Festival in regional Victoria. Thanks to RI Oz and their Free Range Science program for this event. And my thanks also to Harry Greenwood. Head to the website for more information about the programs, and you can also listen to them again there. Love to get your comments too, and why not set up an All in the Mind podcast? Go to abc.net.au/radionational. Click on All in the Mind in the program list. We're on Facebook and Twitter as well. Anne-Marie de Bettencourt is our sound engineer today, and I'm Lynn Malcolm. I'll catch you again next week. Bye for now.
Are radical religious and political leaders in Israel driving young Jews away from Zionism? And does the trend to intermarriage threaten Judaism as a culture and a faith? It's part two of our interview with the provocative Jewish American author Peter Beinart on the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West, here on RN. And you can download this program from the RN website.